Dennis Joseph, member of this committee. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair. Could I first take the opportunity to thank the committee for inviting us? We always look forward to engagements of this nature because we get good guidance and it helps us to fix what has been fixed and take corrective action. So we appreciate the opportunity to be here. My name is Danielson Lamo. I'm Chairperson of Legal Aid South Africa. Next to me is Mr. Patrick Handelmark. He's the executive in charge of our legal development section. It is his section that is responsible for drafting the legal aid guide for which we are here today. And next to me is Mr. Tepang. Tepang Monare is one of our legal researchers that we employ to make sure that what we do remains relevant. And then we have Mr. Elroy McCallum. He is the Justice Center Executive of Malmsdale Justice Center in the Western Cape here. And behind me I've got Kim. She's a communications practitioner attached to our research office here in the Western Cape. I think that concludes the team that's accompanying me here, Chair. Thank you very much.
The Honourable Member of the Justice and Justice Honourable Member. You can continue with the Honourable Member Bloom is here because he
which is the act that establishes us, that tells us what we should be doing. We are in the process of amending that act, the Legal Aid Act bill is currently with the Ministry Legal Drafting Section, but we hope that through next year sometime it will go through, because we want to believe that the 1969 Act, it should, we should have an act that is post-constitutional, that correctly reflects the constitutional dispensation that we have in this country. So, Chair, the next section that I'm going to be looking at is our that is what the legal aid ratification process should be. And I think we started with the portfolio committee, we presented to them, we're now before the select committee. And as I said, we always get good pointers and good guidance from committees here in Parliament, because I suppose through the structures that the honourable members interact with, they get to be told where the gaps are, what has to be done, or where things are going right. So we are following that process. Hopefully after today, if we survive the process, the guide will go to the next stage, and then hopefully it will be then approved, so that we then start looking at next year's guide. Now, Chair, I have asked the executive, Mr. Handelmark, to be here with us, because he's the man who deals with the pros and cons of the guide on a day-to-day basis. And with your permission, Chair, I want, when I come to the start of the guide, which is where I am now, could I hand over to him so that he can then take the committee through the details of the legal aid guide, and then we can then take the questions and issues and comments that come out thereafter, if that's okay, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the committee. Just to confirm, in terms of what Judge has informed, the Select Committee did report through to National Assembly, and on the 20th of September, National Assembly did ratify the legal aid guide from their perspective. So obviously this is another critical component, and as Judge mentioned, I think it's important for us to remain relevant in terms of the guide and what we do provide for. So just in brief, the legal aid guide of 2009 was the first time that we went in and wrote in what we call plain language. We had a plain language practitioner to be able to assist us. And we tried to structure the document in really three broad parts. Specifically, the preamble that deals with why we exist in terms of what legislation we exist in. I think Judge talked with a lot of that in terms of his initial presentation. The part two deals with policy. And the policy really covers the types of matters for which legal aid assistance is available, how someone qualifies, what are their qualification criteria, which includes the means test. It also then deals with the systems as to how we render legal aid from a legal aid board perspective. And when we say we have a mixed model of delivery, we use both, we'll use JudiCare, which is private practitioners on a case-by-case basis. It's now been reduced to about 7% of our total caseload is done by JudiCare. Then our in-house model called Justice Centres, where we have our own salaried practitioners, which does about 92% of the work. We also then have a cooperation partnerships with NGOs and our university law clinics, which counts for about 1% of the work. And then we also have an impact litigation unit that looks more specifically at class actions or precedent-setting cases or cases that in one case you can establish a principle for a large class of persons. And then lastly, we've also now implemented, and not dealt with there, in terms of, from a policy perspective, also a call centre, a toll-free call centre line. So those are the five mechanisms really for legal service delivery. Advice lines, they can call in from anywhere, we can also call back. And that is also then enables us to link to persons in rural areas, which makes it easier, and also then to be able to link them to our 64 justice centres or the sets out policy broadly in terms of the types of matters, who qualifies, and how we will do it. Then the third part is legal aid procedure. So that really sets out the system as to how do you apply, what forms. And so we've structured the guide then in that manner to also align and make it easier when we move to a new legal aid act, where we envisage that the policy part will become part of regulations and the procedures part will be included in a handbook. And that's how we've, in conjunction with the drafting team at Department of Justice, have been structured with a new legal aid book, which we're hoping to come through to Cabinet this year, if not early in next year. So that's just in broad the legal aid guide. Then I'll deal with, and we've got some slides relating to the amendments that we are seeking to the 2009 Legal Aid Guide, which was also ratified by the National Council of Provinces in, I think, in November 2008, which then we implemented in February 2009, because we have 3 months within which to implement the guide once ratified by both houses. The first that we're seeking is then...
where an accused goes
magistrate with more than 7 years' experience who sentenced an accused person to more than 6 months direct imprisonment. All those cases go on automatic review. So what we look at is, we obviously want to reduce the numbers of automatic reviews, and over the last 10 years, if you look, see our annual report, has reduced from about 30,000 to about 7,000 in the last financial year that we reported on, 2010-11. But we always review it, and at stages, theft, shoplifting, common assault were excluded matters. And where we started looking and seeing that the automatic reviews linked to those types of offences where someone was getting direct imprisonment and going on automatic review, we then sought to amend that. And this is the case in terms of reckless and negligent driving. We are finding that there are more drivers that are now being sentenced to direct imprisonment. We're finding that they're driving for owners of vehicles, that vehicles are not roadworthy and leave them to face the law on their own. And that's the reason why we've sought to include it for offences in the district court. Then in regard to the second aspect, it's really to clarify that we don't provide legal representation before administrative tribunals, specifically if it would be in terms of parole boards and those aspects. In those instances, although legal aid will be available to take any decision on those administrative tribunals on review, so we've clarified that. Then also, the third amendment we're seeking to bring into the diet is a restriction on the number of civil matters per applicant. This is what we're finding, that we have some litigious applicants that are seeking legal aid in 4, 5, 6, some of them 20 cases. And so we're wanting to say we can't always justify legal aid on numerous matters. So we've also then restricted in terms of civil matters per applicant, although there will be a discretion, obviously, for our regional executives to consider in circumstances where it's justified that more than one case can be granted on legal aid from a civil perspective. I think one of the most critical issues in terms of accessing legal aid then is the means test, which we deal with as the fourth issue at 2.4 on the summary page. The proposal is that we look at increasing the net monthly income, which is then after tax. So when we look at someone's income, we look at it after income tax. And then we propose to increase it for single applicants from 5,000 Rand a month to 5,500 Rand a month, and for households from 5,500 Rand a month to 6,000 Rand a month. I must mention here that our means test is twofold. We look at both income, but we also look at assets. Because you can have, and we've had the experience that someone might come and say, I'm an employer, therefore I should be getting legal aid, but sit with millions of rands in assets, or might own companies that are worth millions of rands. So we've brought in a double approach in terms of that. So the second aspect then deals with net permissible asset value. And there we're proposing, where there's only movable property, an increase from 75,000 Rand to 100,000 Rand. And where there is movable property, we increase it from 300,000 Rand to 500,000 Rand where there is an immovable property. We're finding that in terms of the values of properties, specifically housing provided by government, that the values over the years have increased significantly. And we don't want someone to lose their housing specifically in terms of when they need assistance from a legal aid perspective. So that's the proposed increases in regard to the means test. There also is, we've built in discretions for our regional heads and our heads of justice centres to 1,500 Rand, and then also for our ROEs or our regional operations executive for 6 regions that we have to 3,000 Rand. And then to our regional heads also for someone that exceeds assets up to 100,000 Rand that they can approve legal aid where they feel someone would still not be able to afford the cost of the legal representation. And maybe that's, I must deal there specifically with the means test. In terms of the means test and in terms of the constitution, it says where someone faces substantial injustice, and what is the interpretation of substantial injustice? I think that was clarified for us recently in the Supreme Court of Appeal judgment, which I will deal with also a little bit later in terms of one of the amendments we seek, on the matter of legal aid, South Africa versus Park and Bennett. Just to give the committee a bit of background, Mr. Park and Ms. Bennett are charged with about 3,000 offences, really, in terms of asset stripping of companies. And Mr. Bennett sits in farms, but on a farm in the Natal Midlands, valued conservatively, we'd say, at about 220 million. Had spent 21 million rand avoiding his trial for the last 8 years, and then at a stage applied for legal aid, and the court ordered us in fact to give legal aid, and we had to specifically deal with that matter. So that's why we're looking at, from a means test perspective, we're not only bound to it. The means test is only an administrative tool for us easily determine whether someone is indigent or not. But what that doesn't help us to do is determine if someone is able to afford the cost of their legal representation from their own resources. And this is what the SEA clarified for us in terms of what is substantial injustice. And they said someone that's able to afford the cost of their own legal representation from their own resources cannot allege substantial injustice if they're able to afford it. And therefore that, from a Legal Aid South Africa perspective, we only have to grant legal aid to those that are not able to afford it. The means test doesn't determine that, but the means test helps us administratively for 99.9% of our clients to determine whether they qualify or not. So it's an easy administrative tool. The constitutional test really is, what's the cost of your case versus your ability to pay? So the longer your case, the higher the costs, the more complex the case, the longer it is going to, the less likely you are able to afford a trial of 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, 8 years, depending on some of them. And so ultimately we can't stare blankly only at the means test. We also have to look at the constitutional interpretation, and we understand that as an organization, and so we look at that. But the means test is just an easy manner for us to be able to deal with 99.9% of our clients.
I'm not sure if all the committee members are with us, because we want to make this process meaningful to the committee and to us. So I just want to double check through you, Chair. I'm subject myself to your authority whether we should continue this presentation, because I'm not sure if we're all together. Thank you, Chair.
No, Chair, we are with them. It's a good thing that you're saying, but we're noting our questions concerning this, because this thing is very important what it has just said now. I've got a few questions concerning this, so they can continue. I think we will stop them if we don't understand this.
Hello,
Joseph.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. On the same page, but I was just wondering whether we should rather ask the questions why we're here, not having the information in front of us. Otherwise we have to revisit and re-debate some of that information that we hear. So I think if it's a screen out and questions which we are noting, we should actually be able to do it immediately and then deal with it and move on.
So Chairperson, I appreciate what the question and the concern that the judge is having. The judge wants us to go step by step. And be on the board. The judge don't want us to deal with this thing easily. That's why it's important to have the document in front of us. I see that the document, Chairperson, is being distributed now. But Chairperson, in our own time, we must deal with this issue with the session on this thing of the presentation on our own time, not yet. Thank you very much, Chair.
You wanted to ask questions?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, are we agreeing that you'll ask questions afterwards, or if we move on as we hear the information?
Yes, can we note them down and then allow them to finish them?
No. Now that the document is right, can you just point out just where are they in terms of this document?
Yes.
So that we can then go account to the page.
Yes.
1.4.
Yes.
1.4.
Yes.
No, so it's not open.
basically a policy and procedure for partially subsidized legal aid in criminal matters. We set that out. What we've done, what we're finding is more and more is what we call it the gap group. And despite exceeding our means testing, as I explained the issue in terms of the cost, being able to afford the cost of your trial versus the length of the trial, we've brought in a policy specifically in criminal matters now to give subsidized legal aid and not to just fully provide tax subsidized legal aid. So where we find that someone exceeds the means test, is not able to afford the full cost of their legal representation, but can afford a portion of the cost, we will provide the representation, but then have set miles in terms of policy approved by board that they will then contribute to the cost. It will not be the full cost, but that it's not ultimately that the taxpayer funds the full bill, and that they must have an interest in their own case and also then pay towards the costs in terms of the legal representation. So that's what we've dealt with and added from a specifically in criminal matters, then what we call a partially subsidized legal aid in criminal matters. I have dealt with the issue of the regional operations executive and their discretion to increase from 2,000 to 3,000 and 1,000 rand in terms of 100,000 rand in terms of immovable property. Then the next bullet deals with what we say is a fourth stage in terms of our means test. In terms of where we have refused legal aid. We have instances, and this happened specifically in the Porritt and Bennett matter. It happened in the Van der Merwe and Killian matter that's been heard here in the Western Cape. In fact, it's back before the courts yesterday and today, as I understand it. And here what we found was that the courts, in terms of our Act in Section 3B, the courts have the discretion where we refuse to grant legal aid, to call us to report to them, and set out the reasons why we've refused to grant legal aid, and then the courts can then make a decision on the fact that's before them to whether we should or shouldn't be granting legal aid. The difficulty is you invariably have applicants that don't put full information before you, are not as honest as what you would like, and I think the Supreme Court of Appeal did find in the one instance that there was a scarcity of the truth in some of the information they provided, and that we sit with a situation that we can investigate, but only to a certain level in terms of the information that's available to do and set out a case as to why we feel someone shouldn't qualify for legal aid because of their lifestyle. It's quite clear that they're not indigent or poor, not able to afford. The court then, in the Porritt and Bennett matter, despite all this and said, despite the fact that Mr. Porritt and Ms. Bennett don't appear to be persons the lifestyle of a poor or indigent person, she's not able to see either way and therefore ordered us to grant legal aid. We took that on appeal to the SEA, and the SEA agreed with us. Someone that was able to get access to 21 million rand up until that stage to fight continuation with for 8 years of the actual criminal trial, that's able to fly overseas, that says is a consultant to the trust that owns the farm but earns nothing, cell phone gets paid by the trust. The court held that it's not really either of the parties that has an onus, but it's the court that must ensure that the information the court requires to make the decision is given to them. That includes then the process of subpoenaing witnesses, including calling the applicants themselves who are applying for legal aid to come and give evidence and to enable us to cross-examine them to be able to determine needs. And that's what the fourth stage is that we have now implemented there specifically, is to provide for that, to say if the court wants to order us to grant legal aid where we've refused, and there are two appeals within our own process against refusal of legal aid, so it's not only one person that decides, we have two higher levels of appeal, so anyone that's refused legal aid has two levels of appeals within the organisation before they'll even reach this stage of the court's ordering us, that the court must follow the procedure then in terms of how to and allowing us to cross-examine them. And that's specifically why we brought sought that amendment, is then to provide for the procedure as set out and clarified for us by the Supreme Court of Appeal. I don't know, Judge, if you want to come in there at that point on that issue.
comfortable with us as a board now that the Supreme Court of Appeal has clarified that process, because we were facing an avalanche of people who hide their assets and come and use the application for legal aid as a delay tactic to delay the trial. So now that the Supreme Court of Appeal has clarified this, we think it has cut out those people who are using us for their own purposes.
Next, Chair. Then the next amendment that I want to deal with is then specifically in terms of the allocation of duty care. In terms of the current guide, that is centralized, the approval of duty care is centralized at our national office. We find we've reached the stage in terms of our controls and our audit controls that we are able to trace. Maybe I should start earlier. In terms of the allocation of duty care, we have an electronic automated system so that we prevent what was happening 10 years ago. If you knew someone that worked at legal aid or was a clerk that did legal aid at the courts, that you could get more instructions than somebody else that didn't know them. So we've set up what we call an infinitum system. And so it's a computerized system where we rank practitioners according to their firm's BEE scoring that we've set up in terms of employment equity. And in terms of the even spread, not of the numbers of matters, because what you can find is you can give one practitioner a matter and they might earn fees of R1,000 out of it, but you can give another practitioner a matter and they can earn a fees, for example, of R1,000,000 out of that matter. And so what you find is that certain practitioners, although they'll be even in terms of the numbers of matters, in terms of their fee earning, and to spread the fee earning equally across the sector, we've looked at those. So what this computer system does is it automatically generates four of the top ranked practitioners in terms of their score. It looks at, obviously, we've brought in terms of black person will be 4 points, Indian colored 2 points, and white one. So what that then automatically does, in combination with what the fees they've earned, ranks the top four practitioners and sends them an SMS offering them an instruction. If the top ranked practitioner in terms of the scoring accepts, it automatically advises them via the system that they've been allocated the instruction, and advise the other three practitioners that the first rank practitioner has now accepted and therefore that the offer is no longer there. If the first and top rank practitioner doesn't accept, the system waits for 24 hours to give everyone an opportunity to respond, and it will allocate the instruction to the next highest rank practitioner that responded to, so that they are able and they are in a position to accept the instructions. So we've automated the system. If there's any deviation from the system, it has to be approved, and we have an audit trail via the system to understand who approved it and the reasons why that deviation was approved. Sometimes there are urgent matters and we have to be able to then deviate to be able to ensure that the courts run. So this approval of duty care via this system was centralized at national office. With these controls we've got in place, we feel we've reached the stage that that can be delegated down now to our justice centers, that they can do that approval. It's quicker, it responds quicker to the needs on the ground, and therefore that we don't have the delay, that the issue has to then be escalated and centralized all at national office. And that's the reason why we've now built in that even where the justice centers feel they lack capacity to provide the representation, that they're able to approve it there on the ground, and we will be able to check in terms of the reasons as to why they do that. In terms of expert witnesses, I think one of the issues that's always been said, if you have legal representation by Legal Aid South Africa, you don't have access to expert witnesses, and I think we just want to allay those fears quite clearly. Where it's appropriate, we've put procedures into place, the funds are available, specifically budgeted for, to provide for expert witnesses, and we've then clarified and brought into line the procurement of expert witnesses with our procurement procedures. We've got to follow procurement procedures in terms of getting three quotes if it's under 500,000. If it's more than 500,000, it's obviously with witnesses into line with our required procurement procedures. Then item 2.10, really what we're finding is that practitioners are very slow. That we often chided to say that we don't pay practitioners timely. And I can say in terms of our annual report, I think 99.7% of our practitioners' duty care accounts are paid within 30 days. And that's obviously a requirement in terms of the PFMA. And what we're finding, though, is that the accounts from the practitioners are slowly coming through. So once they finalize the matter, the account sometimes comes a year later, 2 years later. And what that impacts on is on our contingent liability. So we also have to always then provide for these matters. So what we've proposed in the guide is that we implement a contractually agreed period of 4 months for the submission of accounts by duty care practitioners once they have completed the matter. So they have 4 months once they've completed life, and it's very similar to in your medical aid. If you want to claim from your medical aid, you've paid a doctor's account, you have to submit within 4 months. If you have a claim in terms of your insurance policy for a motor vehicle accident, you've normally got to lodge the claim with the insurance company within 1 month. The Constitutional Court has found such contractual provisions to be binding and constitutionally valid. What we must remember is this procedure does not apply to our clients or anyone that wanted to institute action against legal aid in South Africa. It doesn't apply to clients. It applies only to legal practitioners and in regard to their accounts that they must submit to us. We say if you don't submit in that time period, then our obligation to pay ceases. Also, if we pay or tax your account and you dispute the amount paid, you have 3 months from when we pay to dispute the amount that we've paid you failing, which also then any claim to dispute that would then prescribe. We have provided for that there is a discretion vested in our CEO to be able to consider circumstances where someone could justify why they didn't or weren't able to submit within those stipulated time periods. But this is specifically because of our contingent liability and or provisions we have to make to maintain a sustainable organization and understand where we are in terms of what we have to provide for, instead of having to keep on growing, making those provisions and or commitments. Then the next item I want to deal with is then quality control tests. It's one of the issues from an organizational perspective, and I think we will go many years in terms of the debate about quality of legal services. As an organization, for our internal practitioners, we've brought into operation an extensive quality control audits, specifically of client files, where each practitioner within the organization will be audited within a 2-year cycle. We review, it's done in two methods. One, we look at the file, and we've set certain requirements for our practitioners in terms of the file. You must have the docket in the file, because there's no way you can prepare and properly consult with the client unless the docket is there. We want to see evidence that the docket has been read and reviewed. We want to see evidence of notes and consultations with the client, what the client has been advised, what the client's instructions were. So we have a whole system where we look to say, there's got to be certain basics in place in terms of the quality legal services to happen. Then the second aspect, apart from the file audit and checking the file, checking whether research has happened, is also then to go to court and do what we call a court observation. Sometimes we do it physically in terms of going and watching practitioners in courts. I think our auditors are finding that a bit difficult sometimes in that the courts don't always run. So they're also now looking at using a system where we get copies of the recordings of the actual court proceedings and are able to listen to those in terms of reviewing then the quality of practitioners in terms of how they presented in court. But that applies to our internal practitioners. At this stage now we're looking to extend it to the duty care practitioners. The one problem we have always had is that specifically where it's a case that is still pending, that there's a question of the attorney and client privilege, that if we had to become party to privileged information between the attorney and the client, and it's the client's privilege, that we could be compelled to be witnesses. We've dealt with that in two ways. Firstly, we're dealing with that now in terms of the new legal aid bill, where we've built in that if we become privy to any privileged information while we're doing that audit, that we none of our practitioners that are reviewing the files will be compatible witnesses. And secondly, this one, just to get it going now, that we start this check in terms of the practitioners who render duty care services that are contracted to us and not in our employ, that we will look at finalized files and review their quality in terms of finalized files. So that if we find problems from a quality perspective, that we can address it with them as practitioners, and at stages consider whether they can continue to be on our accreditation list as practitioners who we want to render services. I think then the second last item in terms of the amendments that we want to bring to the committee's attention is then legal aid tariffs in both criminal and civil matters. We stipulate tariffs in terms of the guide. Those are contained in Annex E and Annex F. They're obviously not commensurate with commercial rates, but the board has looked at it extensively. We've looked at what the insurance companies like LegalWise and that pay, what's available in terms of the criminal tariffs, and we've aligned them of the view that they offer reasonable remuneration for the work to be done. But we obviously reviewed every year from an inflation perspective, and as you will see, the increases for 1st of April 2010 was a 4% increase, and from 1 April 2011, it was 4% from 1 April 2011 and 5% from 1 April 2010. So that the tariffs remain in pace with inflation. So we do review them annually to make sure that they keep pace. The last item is, and it's a major amendment in terms of Annexure O, is this accreditation scheme. It was originally in an annexure because at the time of the preparation of the guide, it was still in preparation, so it was added as an annexure. It's now time to add these policies and procedures with regard to the accreditation of practitioners, what we require of them, what they must prove to us in terms of being able to accredit the requirements we have of them in terms of if they want to appear in the IFA, having at least 2 years post-admission experience. We won't just allow newly admitted practitioners to appear in the High Court. So that all this policy relating to the accreditation of practitioners, how they're also removed from the system, and the contract that we have with them, because we only have a contractual relationship with these duty care practitioners, and to set out the terms and conditions on which we are prepared to contract with them. Very often they complain to the courts, well, I'm not getting paid enough. And the courts will want to come, and then we quite often get judges writing to us, we think you should pay this person X amount per day in the court. And we have to go and revert back, and we've even litigated an issue like that in the courts, to say the tariffs are set by the board, and the courts can't stipulate at what rates we should be remunerating, and the practitioners know and understand what our rates are when they contract with us, and on what terms and conditions they contract with us. So that this sets that all out clearly, specifically for practitioners, and binds them in contractually to agree to then render services in accordance with the terms and conditions we've set in terms of the Legal Aid Guide. And that's the summary then of the amendments that we seek to the Legal Aid Guide. Chair, and I seek your guidance. In terms of the presentation, there's a lot more detail in terms of the guide as it stands, in terms of the types of matters that we currently cover, and that I'll be guided by the committee. I'm not too sure if the committee wants me to take through all that detail, because I've dealt with then the amendments that we are seeking. All those that is there was what was already approved in ratified in 2008 by both houses. And I'll be guided by the chair.
No, Chair. It's fine for me. I don't know what other members would die. If that is what they're looking for the amendments only, it's fine, we can ask them questions on that. I don't know about other members.
So I think we will go through them on our own later. There are a lot of members who can engage with the presentation.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Let me ask a layman's question. All this information that we are giving us today, do you have a roadshow, all the amendments? Do you plan a roadshow to inform the communities? Because this is taxpayers' money. Communities need to know where they can get legal assistance and how far. And I would appreciate it if you guys can do it
in at least four of South African languages, it will be a good thing, so that the people on the ground can read and understand the things in their own language where they can get assistance. The other question is, what is the legal aid board, what does the legal aid board do to keep all the good attorneys within a legal aid board? And how do you plan keeping them? Okay? Just explain, just clarify me, this JCE business, what is the JCE? Discretion in district court matters. Just explain that to us, please. I would like to understand that one. And then, there's other questions. I've written them down here. I'm devoted just now. Yeah, I understand the amendment that you're looking for the guidance concerning people who got assets and all that. What if a person is staying in a 1 million rand house? He's got no investment, he's got no income now. What are you going to do with that person? There is proof. He's staying in a 1 million rand house, the house is paid off, he's got no other money, he hasn't got any income. What are you doing with that? And then this case that you explained to us about the Porat and Bennett case, I would like to ask a question here. And I'm not trying to be funny. Unfortunately, I'm coming from a town where if you go to court, you can go and listen to the legal people who represent the people. And fortunately for me, I've got access to that court. What are you doing? Or where can a person go if a legal aid representative, like any of your attorneys and advocates, are rude to the client in front of you, and the client is illiterate? The client doesn't know what to do. The client just accepts everything what this legal representative is saying to him. Where can you go with that legal aid representative? Because it's quite a concern. I had two cases in Upington. Fortunately, one of the advocate's husband knows me very well, and we had a meeting and we sort the thing out personally, and it's not a good thing. So and in the other case right now, the guy is sitting in prison. He's been sentenced because of the negligence of the legal aid representative, and I'm busy with that thing in Upington. But if I can't go further than that, I'll bring that thing to this petition committee of parliament. I thank you, Chair.
Maybe in addition to the question that is Honorable Gunda, do you have the mechanism to check the competency of the lawyers you used to represent the accused in court? And raising this issue, because it was raised during the Access to Justice summit that was recently held, that in some cases, legal aid board sends lawyers who are incompetent. I'm saying this with all respect to legal practitioners, recognizing the time and effort used for one to become a legal practitioner. But what is the mechanism we use to ensure that those people are competent enough? And I will not
on this thing, my experience that some of these practitioners see this process as a quick way of making money and not representing clients. A lot of clients went to prison precisely because they are coerced to admit guilty, because so that they can negotiate a lenient sentence with their counterpart in the prosecution. And I know of a number of people who have gone through that particular process. farmers of the prison and prison somehow. And I'm not sure as to how do you monitor that process. How do you monitor that process? Because people that know they are not guilty, they were not there, they're not, but they were forced. That is one. Basically what I see, and taking the case you're citing of vanity, what I see is this amendment comes at the point that you want to, you're dealing with the rich. Because the point has been raised here. A destitute person, a person who will not had nothing, whatever, inherit something, which is more than what my colleague has indicated here. And unfortunately, there's something happening. There's a family that has to stay there with him and all this. What do you do in that case? Because you see, the value is, let's say, almost 5 million of that particular property. What do you do? Because you know that this person has just inherited this place, and this is what is happening to this person. So I understand that you see, you're basically, precisely because of specific experiences, I'm not sure as to in terms of your own research, because you're a research specialist. Have you dealt with this thing holistically? Checked everything else? Because, and I looked at this in terms of the increases too, that your I mean, unemployment is rising now, as we speak, whilst we are increasing the situation. I'm not sure, is it based on the people that have? Because the person might, at this stage, today, when you check what this person is earning and it gets arrested, and unfortunately this was nothing. Unfortunate, because we live from hand to mouth. How do you deal with that situation? Because if you take 5,500, even if you stay in the township, I'm coming for money. A 4-roomed house does not cost less than 300,000. It's just a 4-roomed house. Let alone that RTP house that is sold for close to 200,000. A 1-roomed house. And I'm just saying, what is it that you have done around this particular situation? Because you see, to me, what it says in terms of what is happening here is the poor will continuously suffer, whilst the rich will be taken care of. That's what it tells me, because basically you are trying to deal with those people that are rich, trying to make sure that they don't manipulate the system itself. They don't take advantage of specific situations. But have you looked at this whole thing holistically? And I'm looking at this increases taking the situation in the country today. That is one area. Check, maybe let me stop there, so that we get some clarity, then we come back later.
Thanks, Chair. As usual, I will beg the indulgence. I had to present, let me start with the generic question. I think that perhaps we could go to the judge, and it's more to the scope of the service. I think I'm referring to what the judge was saying earlier on, citing Section 35. And it's just it's more of a curiosity question, I guess, as to in terms of those cited clauses and the practice now and the guide, as we're talking about it now, what this service, is it a service to the in an offence just for defendants, or it does happen that the complainant and the defendant need service in that scenario. What happens may make before continuing, make a general comment in my observation with the amendments and my listening carefully on the presentation. I think these are good amendments in a way that they are trying to continuously help us to handle the legal services in more better way, efficiently. I think they do. My understanding of, for instance, the clause that my colleagues have covered on, or hammered on the means and the scenario of for now, particularly the Bennett case. I think it's issues of really access, allocating appropriate and proper access to those who need the service, and I think it's a good amendment in my view. Getting back then to the question, the presenter started saying, I don't know whether it was just an opening remark, but it confused me a little bit. He said that their concern is not about your criminal, criminal matters, it's regional, and those. I don't know what he meant, and then he went on to talk to the civil matters in the lower courts, I guess. If he could clarify himself, then what the, particularly the weight concern, they are not concerned what was he trying to communicate there. I think for me more all of what I'm trying to get at is more clarity, of course, having not the benefit of the detail. The other clarity that I would need relates to the tribunal, the tribunal matters or matters before the justice tribunals. I didn't get it properly from the presenter as to what was he saying. Is he saying that they are now providing services to those people in those in those circumstances, or the amendment seeks to do it? Now, my major concern, Chair, is that amendment that seeks to put limits on. I'm not too sure whether I will be convinced today about it. I do understand what the purpose or the intention is on the limitation on the numbers of, in civil matters, limitation on the numbers of matters that can be covered. You even mentioned that in some instances people might go up to 20, and that this thing you want to limit to some extent. I'm not too sure whether you are saying strictly one, but one discretion, one or more discretion. What I'm trying to say is really more detail in this way. But because I'm looking at civil matters, how are you treating civil matters? Are you treating them? You know, it could be what. Stealing here, another. I mean, it's like your theft matters alone, and I'm not too sure as well. It might be many other matters that are far different, that are not related to one offence, but different offence. I guess it's just that I'm trying to think of an example. In the civil matters that are far different, and if there are more than one or more than two, and the guide says you're not going to attend to them, so I'm trying to get the rationale. Is the rationale simply an expense issue? You know, we're trying to limit the resources because we don't have the resources, so that we understand it in that context. That's this clause of limiting the number of the matters, you could, you mean you could offer service, I mean support on, you know, there should be at least not more than that. So, but for me, it is a major concern. The, I know my colleague spoke about, you know, I think it's your amendment with the regards to the judicial and even the accreditation and I think in the tariffs that are related to that. You know, the scenario of, in the matter of that matter that is subject to care, that the Terre Blanche matter, where what we were reading in the media was that there were some, I don't know, sloppiness in as far as, you know, finding the legal representations of loans, the appropriate one, and I think there are many other cases that have caused that, those kind of delays where there's simply, despite the fact that you are saying there's a guide and people are accredited and contracted and they're in the system, now when all of a sudden they turn away, they can't proceed with the matter, and you have to find another person that will go for that cost or that tariff that you are offering. The other area, Chair, that relates to the to understand the system, the automatic system, the computerized system. You're running a database of those that you have approved as such, and is the question of them availability, a limitation of the capacity of those. If you have 10, 20, just for an example, or you continuously add on them, and how do they, how do you do that? You advertise so that you keep them in a database, or you know, just if you could understand that. But I think it's a good system as well. So, hence I'm saying, Chair, that overall I am satisfied that the amendments that are brought before us do take us a step further in the right direction, I think, in trying to provide the service as such. And I think I remember some, Chair, that just slipped out of my mind, but thanks.
Okay.
I'm not sure who's coming, because they deal with the, maybe they should just indicate to us as to, in terms of their own tariff, that they are paying those practitioners. Can that make sure that we get the best attendance or best advocates? Because the problem might be the tariff might be too low and those people might not want to take cases from them. If they can indicate, because we don't know what Atin is charged, we don't know what is, you know, we don't know that, but in terms of their own territory, they can explain the situation. I mean, the example given around the Treblinka situation might be that the cost, you know, was an issue around the cost, and that legal representative said, I can't wait for this, you see. And you might not get the best for this case. I'm just saying, explain to us that situation.
Yeah, sorry, Chair. There's a sentence that they're putting here in the amendment, sought to be guide to the guide. Legal representation before administrative tribunal is excluded.
Yeah, that's what
And the sentence after that says, save that legal aid may be available to review the decision of such tribunal. Can they just clarify that to us?
That's what I want.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for all those questions. Let me start by talking to the quality assurance questions that were raised. I think Honorable Member Gunda, if I'm not mistaken, raised some matters in Arkansas and also made Chair, we have what we call a legal aid ethics hotline. It's a toll-free number that anyone can call to report any deviant conduct by our lawyers. That line has been in existence for a number of years. And it, as Chair, it pains me sometimes when people don't use that, because we run an organization of over 2,000 people, and the lawyers are over nearly 80% of that number. Right? It is human nature that you'll have deviant conduct here and there. If we don't know of that, we will not be able to fix it. That's why we encourage people to say, there's that hotline. In all our adverts, that number appears. So if anything you see, like a legal aid lawyer being rude, or coming to court unprepared, or doing something that you see is wrong, phone that number, because we will follow it up. I'm happy I hear that there are cases in Upington. I'm sure I'll be able to get more details from it so that we can follow. How we follow, and I think another question was, how do we look at the competency of our lawyers? We do not allow any newly admitted lawyer to appear in the regional court or high court. We do not do that. We have also phased out a number of the candidate attorneys that used to appear in the district courts, where we now field qualified lawyers in the district courts to deal with this complaint, that we field inexperienced and unqualified lawyers. It pains me when I continue to hear it, because I want to believe that the statistics that Patrick mentioned, that we have reduced the number of automatic reviews from over 30,000 since 2002 to less than 8,000 in the past financial year, tell a story. When I took over as chairperson in 2002, I said that I'm going to use the statistics of automatic reviews as an indicator of whether we are effective as an organization and as to whether people have confidence in our lawyers. Now, I don't know if people understand what automatic reviews are. When I took over, automatic reviews are the people who will say, I'd rather not be represented by a legal aid lawyer because he's not good, he's whatever. That was the perception when I took over in 2002. I said, I want to make sure that when government spends money on legal aid, there must be value to that money. I want to kill this conception. That was my aim. And it's true. You have people like that. When they appear, says, do you have your own? He says, no, I don't have a lawyer, but I don't want the government lawyer because I'll go to jail. Mm-hmm. That was the situation in 2002.
Mm-hmm.
The situation has changed now. I can assure you. When in 2002 we monitored the number of automatic reviews, these are people who conducted their own defenses unrepresented and were convicted. The law says because they were convicted either for less than 3 months, over 3 months by a magistrate who's got less than 7 years, it goes to a high court judge to review if that magistrate did everything properly. So those are the people who showed us that if there are many people who conduct their own defenses, it means they don't have confidence in us. The number was over 30,000. You can see it in our annual report. We slowly engage the magistrate to say, how you explain the Mahala lawyer concept, the free lawyer concept, has a way in influencing people not to take the service. We are socialized into believing that if you pay nothing for something, it's not worth it. You see? So we went into roadshows with magistrates to say, you must explain this properly because the Constitution is serious when it says, avail these services free of charge. You see? And magistrates went on board. And we won that battle to say, instead of a magistrate saying to the interpreter, just tell the person about the Mahala lawyer. If they started putting dignity into the statement, and the government lawyer is the same as a prosecutor. If a prosecutor is prosecuting me, how can I trust his colleague?
Mm-hmm.
You see? So we've sorted all those things out. Check. When we say the number of automatic reviews have reduced, I repeat, it tells its own story. Because if the national figure was something like that, I think it was 32,000 plus nationally, the number now is less than 8,000 nationally. That tells me that we've been successful in creating that confidence.
Okay.
And going hand in hand with that, we have created a quality assurance unit in the organization. You can go to any lawyer in this country. None of them have quality assurance unit that look at how their lawyers are doing. We've instituted that because we're spending public funds. We want to make sure that the fiscal has to have assurance that the money we pay our lawyers goes to good use. That assurance unit, as Patrick said, they look at the performance of each of our lawyers, our own lawyers, to say, this lawyer needs more attention, he is high risk, put more supervision around him, put more guidance, have more case discussions with this lawyer. We have all those units at all our justices. They also look at their files. Our quality assurance unit statistics speak for themselves in our annual report. I'm not saying none of our lawyers don't do wrong. Understand me. It's human nature. You do have one or two cases where something goes wrong. It's human nature. We are not automatic machines. But I have confidence as chair of the board when I look at the reports I receive quarterly that the quality assurance units are doing what they were meant to do in terms of risk rating our lawyers and putting support structures around those lawyers to make sure that they render quality service. So those are just broad statements to deal with those two aspects. To say, tell us. It doesn't help us to read in the paper that legal aid lawyer or method didn't proceed because legal aid lawyer not found or legal aid lawyer not prepared. It doesn't help us if we don't know what the details are because we're able to follow up. The Teleblanche matter, I'm happy it was mentioned by the Honorable Member, because you see, when a lawyer works for the Legal Resources Center or the Women's Legal Center, these are legal NGOs that employ, you can hardly ever hear them being criticized for work that is below quality. But we have employed people from those centers. Immediately overnight, they become legal aid lawyers. People start looking at them as the worst of the reality. It's a perception, Chair. It's a perception, and I think we should start embracing the good that we have and making sure that we sustain the good that we have. Our lawyers go to the same university. They write the same board exam as every other lawyer. And we put other measures to make sure that they continue education-wise in terms of development in the practice of law, that they continue being in touch. We do all those things. In the Teleblanche matter, because it was a high-profile matter, we cover all costs in this country in terms of when a person first appears, if he has got no legal representation, our people are on hand to take the legal aid application. And if he qualifies, a lawyer will be assigned to that person. So they are not delayed. What happened in the Teleblanche matter, because it's a high-profile matter, lawyers were promised stashes of funds to represent those people involved in the matter. And when our lawyers were in court, they were chased away to say, look, these people don't need legal aid lawyers.
Mm.
I'm on record, you can quote me.
Yes, true.
Our lawyers were chased away to say, look, our people don't need legal aid. We will be covered. But then what happened? Then you start having Nicodemus approaches. Chair, look, the monies we were promised are not here. We are steeped into this matter. We've incurred so much funds. Can legal aid provide us with legal representation? It annoys me, Chairman, because we were there from the beginning. And when that happens, that's what starts delaying the matter. And you read. And who gets blamed? Legal aid. It's not our fault.
We were there from day one. So we were then forced to say, okay, you do the application, then let's look at it. It's true. You have people who want to charge commercial rates. We can't pay commercial rates on the legal aid fund to get the change.
Mm.
We can't.
Mm.
That's why we have the main text, to make sure that we represent the people who need the help, not people who don't need it, but who just want to save by using legal aid. We can't do that. If you look at what's happening in the first world, legal aid budgets are being cut left, right, and center. It's affecting legal aid assistance. It's not going to happen in this country. Because we knew well ahead that they are going to be cut, and we've planned ahead for those cuts. So that's how we use the money we get from the fiscal church. So in Terre Blanche, it's not our fault that the men have been delayed. But I know, as we speak, that we are involved. I've had to have discussions with one of the senior counsel involved. Said, look, there's a legal aid tariff, the highest you can go is there, take it or leave. If you can't take it, we'll find someone else. A Volkswagen can cover the same distance as a Rolls Royce. The speed may be different, but we all get the same thing. That's our motto. So, Chair, I think that was just to deal with those broader issues about quality, about access. Now, in terms of the availability of the service, I think the first question asked was, do we do a roadshow with community? We have justice centers in all the major centers of the country. Where we have determined that it's not economically viable to have a justice center, that is to spend so much money and put a structure there because the demand doesn't justify it, we put what we call a satellite office, the smaller office, right? But those justice centers and satellite offices link with community organizations around them. And when we approve a guide or anything happens, our justice centers have it in their justice center performance monitor to say what community fair play engagements have you had with the people around you. Those engagements are meant to educate those communities about their legal rights, about what is available to them via our guide, how they can assess it, how they can report deviant conduct on behalf of our lawyers, by our lawyers. So we have those structures nationally.
Thank you. I would have never asked that question, Chair, if I know from the area where I'm coming from, those things that the advocate is saying, it's not happening in Upington. The people don't, only the people who can read Afrikaans and English, people who can read, let me say, people are earning more than 5,000-7,000 in Upington. They know about the legal aid board. I'm assisting, I'm sending, I don't want to mention the lawyers' names, I'm sending hundreds of people to the legal aid board. I'm sending them myself. Sometimes I go with them, me myself, I'm taking them there because I know the people are working there. I know one of the attorneys also who was a good attorney, no longer there, is in another company that also in Upington, a very good person. My concern in Upington is not that the legal representatives are weak. No, my concern is that all this very important information doesn't reach the people in Pabalelo, doesn't reach the people in Rondomskrit, doesn't reach the people in Louisville West, in Swartkop. It doesn't reach those people. That's my concern. And I believe, Che, if this information can reach those people, this advocate will come back and phone me and say, hey, Gunda, there's a lot of work to be done in that area. Because people need legal assistance in Upington. I would not ask this question, Chair, if I'm, as a Radio Riverside, community radio station, I'm every second Sunday on the radio for 3 hours on a time, every second Sunday. Chair, when I'm at home, I listen to that program. Legal Aid was 3 times on that radio for the past 5 years. 3 times. That's a community radio station. And that's my concern. All I want legal aid board is to advertise them more to the ordinary people on the street. That's all, Chair, we're pleading with. And Chair, I agree with everything you're saying. Because some of the cases are excellent cases. I'm talking about in Upington. I'm not talking about other places. And they've got a good office there. And they've got good people in that office. So that's all I'm pleading with the, if they can just make this thing more viable for the people, and the people must know. Because he must also understand, he was just saying the background that we are coming from. He must also understand that most of our people are illiterate. And it's true what he was saying. When you talk about the people, look, Chair, let me just make an example. 3 months ago, I spoke to a teacher. She's no longer a teacher. She's a pensioner now. She had a problem with her son. Her son is in trouble. She can't afford to turn it. I said to her, let your son is 25 years old. He's no longer your responsibility. Let him go to the legal aid board. No. Those people don't want me. I said, no. You were never there. Go there. If you don't want to go there, let me take your son there. They will represent him. And when I got there with her son, they took up the case. It's those types of things. It's somebody saying, some people have this bad picture of her. They don't want to help this. So that's all I'm dealing with. And I agree with the advocate. If you can just do that, I'll be much happy.
No, they're going to finish.
That's why this man is crying. A lot of fights there after they have been.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm obviously new in the midterm, and I'm obviously new from the middle of this process. So I would like to know more about the vision and mission and objectives. So, on the one point of the mean test is good, but the discretion, I just want to ask, who would determine that discretion? Would it go right up to the Chief Justice, or would it be at the regional level, the cut-off? And what would the criteria be in terms of spelling it out? Then I support the idea of other provinces, all provinces covered, and the remote areas. We're going up to KZN next week, the NGOP, public hearing. What do we do if a question like that comes up next week? In terms of what the Chief Justice said yesterday about accessibility to the courts. How would we then have to, as a responsible leadership and government, have to respond to those things? Because those people are staying in far remote areas. I think the restriction on that amount in several matters are probably going to increase the amount of cases. But I think it should only be for people who need defense, and not for people who want to take someone else to court, because then they have money if they have their assets. So that's really my idea. I also want to ask the question on the point you raised about scoring between 4 points to DE. Does it mean that if the first black person takes the case and scoring, there will be no opportunity for the other groups? I'm just worried about that. And also, does PE mean the firm must be black people? Because you can have a PE firm with white lawyers. That still defeats the object. Now, what is that composition or the criteria that needs to be spelled out? Otherwise, you have silent partners and all these kind of things that go on in the country where the right people do not benefit. So the status of a PE is that the principal support must also be spelled out in terms of that criteria, meeting that objective in empowering and allowing previously advantage lawyers to take control of and who have capacity to take control of such situations. In general, I think, Mr. Chair, I think the amendment is good. It's very detailed, and I'm sure that if the committee have to respond today supporting it, or they feel about that?
Thank you, Chair. And I'll repeat again, I appreciate these questions. The problem I just need to raise, Chair, is I think the detail that's required of us today is in the guide. Yeah? The detail that's required of us today is in the guide. We just came in to say we want to amend some part of the guide. Right? Like how the accreditation system works, how the scoring works, what the PEE, what criteria is applied, all those things are in the guide. See? So I just wanted to say that. Maybe to respond to the broader issues, Honorable Gunda, I'm not disputing what you say. You see, the issue mentioned about community radio stations is an issue that we have now embraced in our 5-year strategic plan formulation to say we need to be more in touch with people who can get us in touch with the people who need us. And we know that community radio stations are a very powerful medium.
Mm.
Right. I mean, whenever I'm asked to comment on radio, wherever, I invite, say, look, let's form those strategic partnerships. We want to build South Africa into a strong community. So we've embraced that. Right. If we continue not having less coverage by community radio stations, we'll have to look at that and say why. Because people listen to radio.
Mm.
People listen to radio. They know that there's a service available where. Obviously, Upington, I've driven that part. I drove from Kimberley to Upington. It's a torturous road to drive. We have lawyers who drive those roads daily to represent these people. But those courts there are sparsely located. And we've got to decide whether do we want to put a resource there that's going to be used for one day in a week, or how do we cover it differently. Right. But we are embracing what you say, Chair. Through you, Chair, Mr. Gunda, we are embracing all those things. I think I wanted to deal with the issue that was raised about retention of good lawyers. We want to believe that after the OSD dispensation for lawyers was implemented from about 3 years ago, it stopped this inconsistency that we had, because people didn't last in our service, because they were always looking at what they could be earning as prosecutors, and then they'd go there. Then they would also go and become magistrates. So OSD equalized the playing field. We no longer have that.
Right.
So we want to believe that lawyers in the public service are now well paid. That includes our own lawyers. Right. So those who leave are those who want to go into private practice.
Okay.
But the good thing about those who leave, I know of one example in Zira, where they left us, but they set up their own office and they became judicare lawyers. Right. They still did our own way. The issue around judicare, Chair, I need to explain it. I can tell you without fear of contradiction as I sit here that most of the criticism you see about late legal aid lawyers, there was once a report about 2 or 3 years ago of a legal aid lawyer who was drunk in court, or legal aid lawyers who don't come to court. I can sit here and be confident that no one can contradict me. We've done our work. Those are judicare lawyers. It's not our lawyers. Our lawyers have got performance contracts. If they don't perform according to those performance contracts, they know they don't get their bonus, and they know that they run the risk of being fired. So judicare lawyers, you can speak to any magistrate, Chair. I challenge Mr. Gunda, Honorable Gunda. Speak to the magistrate in your area. Ask them, if you want a judicare lawyer, or you want your court to be covered, you want a judicare lawyer or a legal aid lawyer? They will tell you they'd rather have the Justice Center lawyers, because they know those lawyers are counted. Right. So one of the amendments that Patrick mentioned about judicare lawyers, they are the people who didn't want us to have access to their files. So you find the judicare lawyer postponing a case without end. You know that when he postpones, if he postpones it 4, he'll claim a full day's fee. So if he can postpone 5 times and the case keeps on the 6th day, he'll have 6 court Patrick was saying was, people who appear in those courts, those are courts that will impose a sentence that's stiff. So legal representation is a necessity in those courts. We limit legal aid representation in the district court because sometimes people get a slap in the wrist. Right. So we're saying those cases that attract those types of sentences, you do not have to field lawyers.
Okay.
Right. I think that's what the comment was meant to, you know,
okay.
to mention. The issue, I think, Honorable Gunda and Honorable Masila, I think they raised it to say, what if someone lives in a million rand house? Our amendments are influenced by the research we've done based on the work, the trends we see coming through our system. People who have those types of situations who apply, we look at, because as a board, we said we want to see the statistics of the cases where you refuse legal aid. And then we want you to tell us why you're refusing legal aid. And as a board, we took a decision to say, look at regulars and residents, right? We've excluded people, but there are more people who are being charged and who don't qualify for legal aid. Let's relax that limitation. That's why we've come to you, because we see more people who need the service are not getting it because legal aid is closed to them. So our research tells us that in terms of legal aid refusals for people who live in properties like a million, we look at things like if you live in a property that was 5 million, the municipality or the local authority has rated it, and there are services that come to that, and you have to maintain those services. How do you maintain? But you can't live free of charge. You get electricity, you get water, refuse removal. All those things come with a price. That's why we want that information. But if the information tells us that, look, yes, this is how much the house is worth, but you do not have it, and there's going to be substantial injustice if you go through your case unrepresented. The Justice Center Executive may have said no, but the Regional Operations Executive, because there's an appeal, internal appeal mechanism, will say no, represent that person. It's all built in up to the CEO level. So no one who will suffer substantial injustice goes through a trial unrepresented. So those cases you mentioned, we have seen them, and it has influenced our thinking in terms of, you heard Patrick saying the regional operations executive has a limit. So if the means test is 5,500, as we see the amendment, but the person ends about 6,000, so he minces it by 500, that's a borderline case, we give legal aid, right? But if say the person earns 7,000, the judge then says, look, I don't have authority. I'll kick it upstairs to the ROE. The ROE will approve legally. All these things are audited. We need to make sure that we do not want, within the first 3 months of the financial year, we've committed the whole budget of legally. Because that's the other thing we need to look at. We have a fixed budget. It doesn't get increased as and when we need. Treasury says, that's 1.2 billion. Make sure you spend it for over the year. That's why we have the minister. Right. That's why we do some of these things. And we're not saying we'll give little money. We give money where it's worth it, and we make sure that there's value for that money. I think that's the assurance I want to give.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. There was a question raised about, I think Honorable Matila mentioned this, about people being forced to plead guilty. I used to hear this, Honorable Matila, when I took over in 2002. Yes, it was happening, and duty care was happening. I used to be a lawyer myself. I would cover Hillbrook Court. You'd find the lawyer who's covering legal aid. This is his day to day. If there are five clients appearing there that day, they are all his. He will make sure that they all get heard that day and that he claims his fees from legal aid. And guess what happened? If they all plead not guilty, they may be able to finalize one. But if they all plead guilty, he finalizes all of them. So that's what gave rise to this problem. Because he knows that if he claims for five cases, there's a lot more money than claiming for one case. We introduced measures to this day, the quality assurance legal unit at Legal Aid will tell you that if you have a lawyer in Appleton who appears, maybe if there's a sexual offense is caught, if in a month he's got 10 guilty pleas, a red flag comes up to say, what happened? So it's not happening. It's not it used to happen, it is not happening. Because my lawyers actually complain to me as chair when I go around to you. Say, but judge, you've tied our hands back. But no. You can't force people to plead what they don't want to plead. Even if the magistrate tells you you don't have a case, if the client says, I am not guilty, that's your duty as a lawyer, to plead not guilty. So it used to happen historically. People used to be forced to plead guilty, but not now. I can give you the stats. I can give you the stats. Chair, I can assure you that. Now, in our means test, I want to assure the committee that we're not saying we're targeting on the rich. Chair, we have a lot of people who take chances and say they want legal aid when we know they have money.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of them. If we did not have this means test, our budget is corrupt.
Well, I'm not saying you're targeting the rich. I'm saying you're basing, I thought possibly through your research and in terms of the amendments, they are based on the rich, you know, because possibly your research went because of these rich people that took advantage of the system. That's what I said.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe I misquoted you. I'm sorry. But we looked at everything. That's why we're able to say, let's introduce this discretion. Because there's a group of people called the not-so-rich group who failed the means test. If those people don't get legal representation, there'll be substantial injustice to them because they'll be convicted unrepresented and they'll spend lengthy time in jail. We call them the not-so-rich group, and that's why we've come with the contributions policy. Patrick told you that there's a constitutional standard that says, can your funds, if you fail the means test, can your money cover the whole trial? If it can't, we are duty bound to provide you with legal representation. So we cover those groups, right? The legal aid guide, I repeat this, Chair, it has all the details about how we deal with all these situations. No one who can go to a trial and represent goes to if they come to us. We look at that and we approve that level. The issue about tribunals, I'll give one example. Let's say the parole board. The parole board is a tribunal. Right. We say we do not provide legal representation for anyone to appear before the parole board. The proviso there says, if someone who appears before a parole board feels that that parole board is wrong or is unfair, and they apply for legal aid, we grant them legal aid, and then we apply for review to the High Court to review that parole board decision. I think that's what that clause said. Yes.
Judge, thank you for what you've just said.
Yes.
I'm saying to you, when we're coming back from people taking parliament to the people, you'll get more than 50 cases in Uppington from the prison. Because what you just said to me now, a lot of those guys were supposed to be out by now, but because of they don't have, you see, just this is where your point comes. The community radio station, you see this information? If they have this information, I'm telling you now, that's all I'm stating. Information is a powerful tool. Now thank you, Judge.
I think, Chair, I've taken a lot of the airtime. the relatives may have some issues that are more pertinent. That because there are some questions that I have that I think I have not answered. That the may still want to answer, Chair. Thank you.
Thanks, Judge. Thanks, Chair. I don't intend to repeat what Judge said. I think we hear what you're saying in terms of communication and information. in terms of it, and one of our strategic planning sessions, and I think it will be critical to share the business plans, and our strat plan will come through to this committee. I think we've identified communication as a critical element. Even if we just look at our client call centre, which has only started June last year, which increases access to advice and information and to be able to link people, and just on that number, we've started extensive advertising. I know we've done a lot of television, but the interesting thing is, and the community radio stations are critical, we found that television, in fact, in terms of the increase in our numbers on the call centre numbers, have linked more than 50% people have seen it on television. So we're now looking at our campaign in terms of television, community radio stations, and I think it's an overall approach. We also have what we call fair play events with the justice centres. Now, each justice centre is required to have a fair play event on an ongoing basis in terms of the business plan. I'll maybe explain that. That's linking to schools and linking to children and saying to them, like, let's explain the rule of law. Let you also understand your rights in terms of legal aid. So we do it in terms of using sport with children and saying, like in soccer or in netball, you have rules. If you breach those rules, the referee, umpire, whatever, will make a decision, give a penalty against you, take you off the field depending on the seriousness of the offence. So we run campaigns linking the justice centres with the schools so that one, the teachers, and two, the children can also become a resource in the community. Each justice centre is required to do this. So as we build and we're building the capacity of the years, we can't cover all schools in 1 year. So it's been a program that's been running. So you try and build this as an organisation to people know that you're a resource, where they can go to. Just in terms of the legal aid guide itself, we've done what we call a people's version of the legal aid guide. Translated 7 languages. Obviously, we in terms of that, we need to look further in terms of getting to all the official languages. We distributed, and it was included in what we call a people's annual report, which we annually send out. And this year, for the 2000, it's not this financial year, but the annual report has just been tabled. Previous year annual report, we did a people's annual report. In that was the client's version of the legal aid guide. We distributed 5 million copies of that in 7 different languages. So I think it is there, and I agree with Judge. You know, we've got to build on it. The community radio stations, we need to get on more and do those things. But we have got various approaches to communication so that we can get the information out to communities. Judges, the JCE, I'm not too sure if the question linked to what is a JCE, and maybe I must just explain that. In terms of, as I mentioned, we have 64 what we call justice centres around the country, and then 64 satellite offices. So we have 128 physical contact points where we have attorneys, officers on the ground. Each satellite office will at least have a paralegal in the office, so that if anyone from the community wants to come for advice, they can come into the office, they will see a paralegal. Satellite office is, it's not a fully fledged attorney's office, but we'll have 3 or 4 practitioners linking to the courts depending on the demand that comes from the courts, and we use them to be more rural based and also to cut down on our practitioners travelling to those courts and also then closer to the communities. So in terms of in terms of that, we have those numbers of justice centres trying to link into the communities. They can access, and then the call centre as well. You can call from anywhere; it's toll free, and also you can leave messages, and our practitioners can phone you back and link you to the practitioners. So I think that's just trying to get the coverage in terms of rural areas. It's a difficult challenge, and I think it's something that we're ongoing aware of, and the board always asks us what you're doing in terms of rural. So we're always looking at it as to how we can address those challenges, linking. I think one of the other issues is linking to advice officers. We're doing a pilot project with SASSA in Gauteng, linking to pension payments, and to see how that works in terms of having our practitioners there, our paralegals there, to provide advice as people are receiving it. The other possibility is linking to clinics, but it's obviously all a question of resources. We've got to see how we do it, and how we develop it over a period of time, but we are testing different methods in terms of how we can link. Just to let the community, the committee know, we're not staring blind and saying this is the only way, and we're not looking further and more. We have a CEO, she always asks us, what's new? She's not not interested, well, that's what we're doing, and we will do the same and same and same. She always asks, what's new? What are we doing differently? What can we do differently? What's the client focus? Focus on the client thing. So I think from an, as an organization, I can say that's, and that's where our board challenges us specifically. Unfortunately, in terms of the million rand house, I think Judge has mentioned it, we're looking to the profession to say this gap. Those that don't qualify for legal aid but also still can't afford it, what do you do as a profession? Where's pro bono? What's happening with pro bono? And we just submitted a report which will go to board in November where we're saying we want to engage with the law society and say, put people up to 12,000 rand per month in terms of that gap group that can't afford it. Use the pro bono system. How can we use the pro bono system and grow? Because there is also a responsibility on the profession to look at what services they render. So we're looking at how do we tap into that to deal with the gap. The civil matter, the limits, obviously there, the civil matter limits links to various aspects. We've obviously got to try and spread our services across a wide spectrum of a client base. Civil legal aid makes up about 7.5% of our total caseload. So of 420 odd thousand cases we've done, about 7.5%, which is just over 30,000, are civil cases. The other 389,000, 390,000 is criminal defence work. So in terms of civil legal aid, we have a limited capacity. So to give one person 20 cases versus another person not being able to assist them, we're saying there's got to be a balancing out. But if you go and have a look at what we say there, is not an absolute bar. So if the justice said to the executive or the regional operations executive, that's our regional head that heads up either one or two provinces depending. We've linked the provinces, the bigger provinces, there's one regional office that covers the province. In other instances, Free State and North West opted together in under a regional office. The RAE can consider it and say, now this is justified that the person can have a second or a third case. We're just building in control mechanisms that on the ground you don't get certain people that can abuse the system and get more help, and others get excluded from help. And I think that's critical. And that also links, obviously, to resourcing. If we had limitless resources, it wouldn't matter. But we don't. And it's also critical. We don't want people that abuse the system to get away. Also, in civil matters, it's critical. We don't give legal aid in matters where we assess that there aren't merits. We've got to be satisfied that we're spending taxpayers' money on matters that have merit and that we've got a prospect of success. Sometimes there are cases that are difficult. You've got to do those too, and sometimes you may lose them. You may lose them in the first instance. I've had instances where judges have told me, no, your clients must be evicted. We take the matter all the way and we've been to the Constitutional Court and we've overturned that decision. So there's also a process. So the fact is that you might lose in the first instance doesn't mean that there's not a right to appeal. And I think in certain instances there's, in criminal trials, we say legal aid doesn't only cover the trial, it covers an application for leave to appeal. And if that presiding officer who presided at the trial grants you leave to appeal, we'll grant you assistance with the appeal as well. If the presiding officer refuses you leave to appeal, we will give you legal aid for a petition to the next High Court. If it's from the Magistrates Court, you will go to the Judge President of the High Court to apply for leave to appeal. If it's from a High Court, you will then go to the Supreme Court of Appeal and ask for them to grant you leave to appeal. If in that process you are granted leave to appeal, we will assist you with the appeal. So legal aid for that is not limited purely to the trial, and that if you're convicted, that's the end of the line. You are entitled to, and we will assist with that application for leave to appeal and release an appeal. Anything beyond one appeal is subject to us being satisfied that there's merit, and we won't necessarily give you a second appeal if you've already had one appeal. So that's, we do build that in. So in terms of if there's a conviction, that process is there. It's a right that's explained, it's in the legal aid guide. In fact, it's part of our audit. You've got to ask the client that is convicted and sentenced to direct imprisonment, do they want to apply for leave to appeal, yes or no? There must be an election in writing. If the person's not able to write, and they must then on the front indicate their election as to whether they want to apply for leave to appeal or not. So that's an election that they're entitled to make. I think so.
Just to check,
No, I'm trying to really understand this area. Is this limitation also in the criminal matters? If not, why here in the civil matter? And is this just, are we leaving it? I hear what the explanation is, but I'm looking at the, my emphasis is on the difference of the pertinence of the case, the cases, and the difference, and the differences, because I'm hearing him saying that he's explaining more about the conducts of human nature, deviant conducts of human nature, and so I'm trying to say, if we could, I mean, is that all, or we think, and you're quoting 7.5% of civil matter, so is it necessary then to limit if this is less than what is not, is less problematic, I guess, as such than well, not that, but what is the scenario with the criminal offences of criminal matters?
Chair, no, in criminal matters, section 35(3) is very clear from a constitutional perspective. We cannot limit your right to legal representation. That will be working on the assumption, well, we'll be going contrary to the constitutional value that you are presumed innocent until proven guilty. We couldn't, as an organisation, come and say, well, we think you're guilty, therefore we're not going to help you. We don't have that as a criteria. We wouldn't be able to do that and justify. So just civil, the problem is we have very limited resources to give to civil. So therefore, if one person is able to command a larger portion of your resources to themselves, it excludes others. So I think it's the balancing act that we have, and I think that's the argument we also have in part of the benefit that we put before the Supreme Court of Appeal. This case, we say, would have cost us $7.5 million as we estimated as to the duration of the trial. Don't take that at an average cost of, say, 2,000 rand in a district court criminal trial. So you go and then calculate out what that 7 or 8 million rand we would have spent on their defense, which was not justifiable. How many other people have excluded that are entitled to legal aid from the system where we would have to limit? And invariably, it wouldn't limit criminal legal aid because we can't. We've got to provide the defense. It would then eat into civil and the resources that are available for civil. So we're always trying to make sure that the resources go to where that's intended to go. And that's for the poor and the indigent that really need it, and not for people that have money and assets.
Okay, in fact, what I wanted to emphasize one thing which was raised by Honorable Kunda, that I'm happy about the amendments. And the judge, I think, has given us more information which says this seems to be on the right direction. But what Honorable Kunda was saying here, I've been listening in my town, Grantham, there's legal aid office there. But people don't want to go there. Because in the past, the point that was raised here, the legal aid has been used to ask people to plead guilty and they be sentenced or whatever. But that's how it is known in our township. Many guys are afraid of going there because if you go to the legal aid, obviously you're going to jail. And it has been, in fact, associated with the past because it was during the apartheid time that it was also there, the legal aid. So I think what they need to do is to use our constituent offices, that if we link with their offices so that people can have access to justice, and we can also work with their offices, communicate with the community, and explain in detail, and use the local radios to communicate to people so that people understand what they are all about. I mean, I think there are many things, especially if you go to civil matters. About these criminal cases, at times I'm not happy about criminals getting this assistance after they've committed crime, but justice is justice. I mean, it must be accessible to everyone. But on these civil matters, I think it's very, very important, because there are times when you see that this member of the community might have a chance maybe to solve the issue in a more proper way, but because of not having access to legal representation, then people tend to leave many, many things. I've seen many, many people, especially the poorest of the poor, losing houses, losing many, many things, but because they don't have money, they can't be represented. You know, there are these people who are borrowing money.
Machonisas
are taking a lot of people's things, loan sharks.
Mm.
But people, because of not having access to lawyers and everything, then they can't defend themselves because these people have money to get lawyers. So if legal aid can just try, have roadshows, go to the communities, explain what is it that they are doing, so that people can act. That's what I wanted to say about this, and I'm happy about the amendments. I think they will have this somehow, but we need to read more. But what I've heard, I think I'm quite happy. Thank you, sir.
The Chairperson, thank you very much.
You have not been given a chance.
Do you still want to engage with the presentation, because they said some of the details are in the
I think they spoke about this sentence, just a sentence. I think in the Western Cape we talk about Tushong sentence. I think the point I want to raise for them is could you have a sentence, but we're trying to get all government centers partners to one place where people can come and not traveling from A to B all over the cities to various government departments. So if they could, they can also link into other services where government already exists. Do not duplicate or allow people to travel in different directions.
No, Chairperson, thank you very much. Mine is only a comment. I want to commend the judge and the people of Legal Aid. You see, this is a step in the right direction. And I know for a fact that where Legal Aid started, and there's improvement. I can tell you there's very, very serious improvement. You see, my only concern in this issue is corruption is very high in the country. Are you also, or let me not ask a question, but it's a comment. Please don't defend these criminals who is looting the country. You can't. That's my issue. You see, on the Blanche's case, I know you are right, Judge. There were people who were seeking publicity stand, because it was a high profile case. Television cameras will be there and all that. And after that, I know that they pulled out because it was a long case. So it's not legal it was to be done. Those people.
No, thank you, Chair. I think that we all agree that the amendments. The one point that I wanted to stress, Chair, is that maybe we will have to deliberate this order now that I've been read, and maybe to get a decision in that specific meeting. That is the first area. The second area, Chair, is I want to persuade legally to represent even those not offenders. Even those that want to bring this. Because you see, the problem I face with just Chief.
Didn't answer me on that one.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying I want to persuade. You take farm workers, you know, who can't even, because of the situation in the country, the past that we are coming from, you know, they have a good case, but they can't represent themselves properly. And prosecutors, in most cases, can't deal with that situation. Prosecutors can't. And I'm just saying I want to persuade my colleague from the Western Cape, you know.
Yes.
That he must move away from that situation, because there are a lot of poor people who have got good cases against, for example, I'm just saying, for example, farmers, you know, some against these accidents, you know, they have a good case against these bus companies, the train, you know all those things. They don't have legal representation because they can't represent themselves properly. How do they deal with that situation?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm
saying that you deal with the legacy now. It's a legacy problem. And that's the point I wanted to raise.
Chair, I think for the record, I need to clarify myself. I only refer to those people where the 500,000 comes in where actually they have money to represent themselves. I did not refer to the other people.
Chair, you have another one?
Yes. Chair, let me... I didn't say this, but let me say to the judge and his team, thank you. I just perused through the document that you've just given us. I can assure my colleagues, as I've read through the thing, it's a very good amendment, and it's a very good thing, like the civil things, how they would do it and all that. But I would plead with them, because my colleague, Louis Zemande, has also asked a very important question concerning the civil matters. If you had one or if you had two civil matters, you can only associate with one and the other one you can't. You can just clarify that. But Judge, I appreciate what you've done, what you guys are doing, really. The reason why I was asking this question is that my heart, and I'm closing with this statement, I was writing a letter for a guy who has been sentenced 20 years in prison for a case, a rape case, only to find out that the whole legal procedure was not proper. And of those 20 years, that guy had to sit 11 years in prison. And after they find out, after 11 years, this, he was being sentenced wrongly and all that. That guy is working for the municipality now. He's got nothing. Those are the things that I'm dealing with, because I'm a man on the ground. My ears are on the ground. My feet are on the ground. My eyes are on the ground.
As a preacher and politician.
And let me assure you, you'll hear from that tribunal cases in Upington Prison. Thank you. It was. We will support this. Thank you.
You know, Honorable Kunda, I made a set of reading to you when Honorable Bloom was talking about the creep. and I have to agree with you. Thanks very much, Honorable members. We have the documents, and then we can peruse them. We'll be meeting again on the 16th, and if there's anything that you want to raise, I hope the door of the judges open, we will interact with them. But thank you very much for your presentation. It has assisted us very much when we go and do the oversight and when we engage within our communities. I hope when there are other issues, you are raised with them, lately interact again.
ANC can't second when they are pro-Palestinian. Let me correct that. COPE is seconding that the proposal from the ANC. No support. All support.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, for the sake of formality, the Select Committee on Security and Constitutional Development having considered the subject of the 2011 legal aid guide referred to, because that it has agreed to the next.
Yes. Agreed.
Agreed. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Chair, and honorable
members. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Judge.
Thanks,
Judge. And just a minute. We'll deal with them in KwaZulu-Natal.
We are not going to a modern case. We have changed our mind. Otherwise, hey, man, we are
scared.
Okay.
We are scared. It's a Mamelodi
Valley phone call. We are scared. When we go there to modern case, would not. We will adopt things that we don't know. I know. What is
Louis, I know.
everything of that. Ik denk dat we dat slecht moeten gaan met de dag. Dat is toch niet meer zo. Nou, wat is er nou? Wat is er nu? Maar dat staat hier voor je erop op te voelen. Coming now, I just want to record this.